Senate Judiciary Committee, Wednesday, February 6, 1991.
Thank goodness. Somebody, gave us an apple.
Yeah. Jim Hill. I gave the apple to my sixth grader.
Yeah.
Katie.
I should have been good.
Ah, sorry, Madam Chair.
No problem. Side of the times.
Another working lunch here.
Right. My apple. I figured my apple was pretty good. Okay, here we go, folks. Committee will come to order. We have on our agenda today, we'll take, we have a work session on Senate Bill 455, which will be first. We'll do some bill introductions, and then we'll take Senate Bill 380, which Doctor Ashman. Dr. Judge from Washington County is here to talk to us about Senate Bill 380. Right. And among other people who may wish to sign up on that bill, by the way. So let's move ahead then to Senate Bill 455. That's the revised bill, and we have Bill Taylor.
Thank you, Madam Chair. As you may remember, this bill was on Monday. It's the annual, the bill that we see every session, the revises bill relating to corrections of erroneous material in the Oregon revised statutes.
Okay. And any amendments to this bill will wait till 2 years from now.
That's
right.
Correct.
Madam Chair.
Senator Hill.
Yes, council has gone through this thoroughly.
Legislative council has gone through this thoroughly.
I assume. Okay. And we don't have any other comments.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 455 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Right. Senator Hill has moved Senate Bill 455 to the floor with a due pass. Discussion. Call the roll, please.
Senator Bunn?
Aye.
Senator Hamby?
Aye.
Senator Shoemaker?
Aye.
Senator Springer?
Aye.
Vice Chairperson Hill?
Aye.
Chairperson Cohen?
Aye. Motion carried. Thank you. Now we have bill introductions.
Thank you, Madam Chair. That's true. We have LC 1688, which for bill introduction, it requires Supreme Court judges to be elected by the legal voters of each of the five congressional districts of the state, providing that remaining two Supreme Court judges be elected by voters of the state at large. Requires that two judges of the Court of Appeals be elected by legal voters of each of the five congressional districts of the state. It's a bill, I believe, that was filed by an attorney from Grants Pass and been forwarded to us, I believe, through Senator Grensky's office.
Yes, so it comes from at the request of Senator Grinsky, and he's asking us to introduce it as committee bill. Are there objections? Senator
Springer. I almost never object to introduction, but I'm going to have to be a no on this one, Madam Chair.
Okay. Springer is recorded as a no vote. This does not necessarily comply that you can
not
have
not because there's any conflict of interest, certainly.
Right. Hearing now, Harry, et cetera, with the proviso that Senator Springer is a recorded as a no vote. So, thank you.
Object to one of those last ones.
Okay, Senate Bill 380. Madam Chair, members of the committee, Judge Ashmanskas is here on this bill. This bill comes to the committee through pre-session filing with the Interim Judiciary Committee at the request of Judge Ashmanskas. The committee members should have Senate Bill 380 plus some amendments, -1 amendments, which were prepared at the judge's request. Basically, the -1 amendments would retain current language with respect to alternate jurors, except that it would permit judges to appoint up to 6 alternate jurors in felony cases. It is currently limited to 1 or 2 alternate jurors. The -1 amendments would also control the manner in which challenges to alternate jurors are exercised, and would equalize the number of peremptory challenges four alternate jurors between the defense and the prosecution.
Okay. Judge Eshmanskas.
Madam Chair, distinguished members of the committee, thank you. I'm Judge Eshmanskas, Don Eshmanskas for the record. I'm a circuit judge for the state of Oregon, for Washington County. I do use Dr. Ash when I make reservations at restaurants. I think you're a dentist with money. So I say, Dr. Ash, party of two, and I always get terrific service. You say you're a judge or a lawyer.
I have a neurologist, a neurosurgeon whose name is Ash, so maybe that's where all this comes from.
Let me say, first of all, I appear in favor of Senate Bill 380 and urge a due pass recommendation on that. I'm authorized to also state that Mr. Bill Linden, on behalf of the Judicial Department, State Court Administrator, shares the views with the amendments. And Mark Ross, who's with Senator Springer today, he advises me he's in favor of it after a consultation, and I hope that's noted. And I'm sure if Mother Teresa were here, she would vote for this if, in fact, she knew about it. The amendments do exactly what Committee Counsel Ms. Swenson suggests. It simply increases the authorization for alternate jurors in circuit court criminal cases from 2 to 6. It'll be rarely used, I believe, but in those cases where you have 7, 6, 8, I have a 3-month trial coming up. I think it'd be beneficial to have the ability to have more than two alternates in the event that something untoward should happen to a regular juror. The language dealing with the death penalty alternate jurors has been deleted, but there is a bill in the House, House Bill 2393, which deals with that specific issue, and I think that's a better vehicle than not cluttering it up here, but makes it a lot more simple in this body. And on the replacement of jurors, alternate jurors, in place of regular jurors after deliberations start in a non-death penalty situation, I think that needs more study, quite frankly. There may be different alternatives. I think it needs additional reflection and be the focus of additional study. I do have one additional request, and that is that if at all possible, and if it meets with your pleasure and this bill is enacted, that an emergency clause be placed on it, and I do so for an ulterior reason. I'm scheduled to start an aggravated murder trial for 3 months that will last at least 3 months beginning around July. And if I had the ability to have more than two alternates, I would certainly take more than two alternates in a 3-month case or even longer because of the amount of witnesses from out of the country. We're going to have some scheduling problems. So I add that as an afterthought, and it's not crucial, but it would be helpful. With that, I'll do the hardest thing a judge can do, and that's stop speaking and entertain your criticisms or your suggestions or anything else, madam.
Other questions from the judge? Let me make a little yellow line where you think you're still going to kind of circulate this around among your colleagues and do a little bit more study. Are there other areas here within the amendment still that you want to further reflect on, or are you talking about things you've left behind?
Things are left behind. I approve of the amendments because it makes that clean approach that Ms. Swenson is, and on the other two issues, the death penalty alternates, that the House bill can deal with that, and I'll go to the Bar Association, maybe an interim committee or a task force, and try to generate some interest and some research and some different approaches.
Right.
Is that
Senator Springer first?
Yes. Excuse me. Judge, I haven't had any experience in a case that's required these kinds of alternative jurors, but does the court pretty much have discretion in this area? Are there any rules, or how does a judge make the determination that, well, this looks like a case that's going to require some? Is it just kind of how it feels, sniff test per judge? Or?
Of course, we're never quite that intuitive. We're focused on the grip of our function. Actually, it's in consultation with the attorneys. Typically, if I have a case that's going to go more than a week or over a weekend, I like to pick an alternate just in the event that someone has emergency surgery or has to go off and we can continue the trial. If it's, for example, I had a 7-week, 5-defendant case, it's no question we wanted two jurors, and the attorneys agree, and we have two alternates. I just finished a 6-week civil trial with antitrust and other issues, and we had only two, although we could have had six, but we decided in consultation that six would be, two would be sufficient, and I think it was understood that if we got down to 11 jurors, we'd go with the 11 rather than having a mistrial after 5 weeks of a civil case. But it's in consultation with the attorneys. It's a little bit of experience. It's a little bit of their input, whether the attorney, he or she, thinks it's a wise thing. So
that's helpful. Thank you.
Thank you.
Senator Hill.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, Judge, I wanted to ask you, this would allow you to replace a juror any time before the verdict?
Before the submission to for deliberations. In other words, at any time up to I send the jury out to deliberate, you can replace that regular juror in either a civil or a criminal case with an alternate. Once deliberations begin under the present law and under this bill, forgetting the death penalty situation, I excuse the juror once the alternate juror, once the regular jurors go into the jury room.
And when you say deliberation, I excuse my ignorance for this, but before deliberation, you mean by the jury?
By the jury, yes.
So are you saying that someone could be replaced who hasn't heard anything about?
Okay. If I may respond, Madam Chair, Senator Hill. The alternate juror is selected right at the beginning of the trial, alternate or alternates, and hears all the evidence, attends every session, and is in fact instructed to be attentive and to play particular, and they look at exhibits and everyone else just in that event. And I talked to them at some length about their role. So they've heard everything, and it's, as I say, after I give the final instructions to the jury, they go into the jury room. I excuse and discharge the alternate juror, and this bill would continue that practice.
Now, prior to this time, would there have to be stipulation of the both parties before prior to this bill?
No, it's up to the judge has a discretion.
And always, this has always been up to your.
Yeah, it's always been a discretionary.
So you're just changing the numbers then.
Right, to conform to the civil side, and because of some.
And so, in other words, you can have six people sitting. Okay.
You could have 12 plus 6 or 12 plus 1, depending upon what you believe to be appropriate. And I don't think it's going to be a big money measure. I don't think this requires a fiscal impact because, if anything else, it would save a mistrial and having to retry a case if you had had gone 6 weeks and ran out of jurors.
Madam Chair.
I hope that's responsive, Senator.
Thank you very much.
Senator Hahn.
Yeah, Ash, that's what I was going to ask you about, because in our committee folder it notes no fiscal impact, and I'm confident that as an alternate juror, I'm still paid my, what are we paid jurors today,
$10?
$10
plus 8 cents a mile,
whatever,
or something that, Senator Hanby.
But I'm glad you clarified it, because surely it would have been a question that would have been asked on the floor.
If I may, Madam Chair,
sure, please.
I'd say for the employers here, Senator Schumacher and Senator Springer, is that 90% of the case, like in district court, there's rarely an alternate juror, first of all. In circuit court, if it's a week or less, which 99% of the cases are, there's rarely an alternate. It's only in these extraordinary situations like aggravated murder trials, lengthy civil complex cases where you want to be able to complete the case, that's when you use it. And so the dollar amount is so minimal as opposed to the savings in retrying it that I think that I could honestly state that there is a negative physical impact in it. Okay.
Anything else? Any questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I always appreciate appearing here.
Good. We like to see you too.
Madam Chair, are you prepared to at least amend it for an emergency clause? Or
we'll schedule another time for work session, and we'll add the. I've made a note on the emergency clause possibility, and we'll deal with that in work session. And since we have anyone else who'd like to speak to Senate Bill 380? Thanks very much, then. Let's move ahead to Senate Bill 376, which is the judge might have an interest in this one, too.
I'm too soft. I never find anyone in
town. We don't believe that.
I have to go back to work. But
okay.
Bye, Mark. Nice
Senate Bill 376, Ingrid, and we have the we have Bill Linden here from the Judicial Department, and
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 376 is a fairly comprehensive revision, or at least rewriting, of the statutory law of contempt in Oregon. It's an effort, I believe, to clarify the law, to consolidate the rules with respect to sanctions which are remedial and sanctions which are punitive, to do away with distinctions in the current law that tend to conflict with a Supreme Court case decided in 1988, the Hicks versus Fiat case. So this bill would try to address the issues raised in that case, clarify, standardize, simplify the procedure in these contempt matters. It's based in large part on a Wisconsin statute. A copy of that statute was provided to members. And there is a section-by-section description in the staff manual summary.
And I want to say that the people have, we had a number of hearings on a contempt bill last session, and kind of got into high water. And people from Bill Linden's shop and a number of other interested parties have been working on this during the interim. So it's not easy, and I want to thank the people ahead of time who worked so hard on it to try to get something to bring to us for what we have here today. And I don't know, at what point do you want to have Dave come up and go through the bill? But I'll let you do that first, Bill. Go ahead.
Madam Chair, for the record, I'm Bill Linden, State Court Administrator. I just wanted to give some brief comments about how we got to this point, and then Mr. Hendricks is going to describe the changes the bill represents. In both the 1987 session and 1989 session, there were bills in to substantially revise the contempt laws and procedures. And for a variety of reasons, those bills did not move. The argument, the most prominent in 1989, was that the purported simplification was more complicated than what we had. So we went back and started thinking about this whole area again after the 89 session, and I appeared at the first meeting of the interim committee in September of 89 when you met at the bar convention, and described what I thought were the major issues in this area and outlined what our plan was for interim study and work on it. Essentially what we did was we set up a committee, and the two key players in that committee were Judge Paul Lipscomb and Judge Milo Pope, both of whom could not be here today because they're in trial, who were nominated by the Circuit Judges Association and the District Judges Association to represent them in our committee work to try and make come up with a bill in this area that would make some sense. So we began that committee work, and at various times through the interim invited interested parties to either come to meetings or to look at drafts of what we were doing. And so, excuse me, some of those interested parties are here today, but just to run down the list quickly, of those who we have consulted with, the Criminal Defense Lawyers, the District Attorneys Association, the State Bar Committee on Family and Juvenile Law, the State Bar Committee on Judicial Administration, the Circuit Judges and District Judges, the Juvenile Rights Project, the American Civil Liberties Union, Oregon Legal Services, and both OTLA and OADC received copies of the various drafts. I don't recall exactly what draft number we ended up on. I think we had at least four or five revisions from where we started. Basic thing we're trying to do here is to simplify and make more understandable and usable the contempt laws in the state and the procedures that come with them. We do have to conform our laws with the Supreme Court case that counsel referenced. And that Hicks case basically says that alleged contemnors, persons who've been accused of contempt or charged with contempt, who are facing what's called a punitive sanction, have many or most of the rights of criminal defendants. And there's a very, I think, urgent need to make sure that our law reflects that Supreme Court decision. With that, though, and with the chair's
approval, I think that I'd like to defer Mr. Hendricks to describe the actual changes that the bill represents.
Yeah, if you just stay there, so if we have policy questions, we can ask you or as a representative of the judicial branch, and then let's have Dave come up and just go through the bill. So basically,
thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee, Dave Hendricks from Legislative Counsel's office. This is kind of a dread day for me. I've always, after all those years going to those bar functions to follow Judge Ashmankus as a speaker, has got to be everybody's worst dream. He's really great. The bill, as already mentioned, is based on two sources, the Wisconsin statutes, which I believe counsel said you had a copy of, and an attempt to conform our statutory structure to the Hicks v. Fiat case, and I'll refer to it as Fiat just because I've gotten used to that reference. As Bill Linden has indicated, Fiat basically set up a structure. It's amazing, actually, as a Supreme Court case, a U.S. Supreme Court in that court case, in that it actually gave some clear guidance to the states in how they need to structure their contempt statutes to be in compliance with the federal constitution. It said if you are going to impose certain types of sanctions, punitive sanctions, you do need to give that person that you are going to be imposing those sanctions against the same rights and protections that you're going to give a defendant in a criminal trial. Now, of course, they didn't really enumerate what exactly those rights may be in any given case, but they said to the extent that the Constitution provides the right, if it is a punitive sanction, quote unquote, you do need to afford those defendants that right. And looking at Section 1 of the Act down at subsection 3 and 4, you find that one of the four definitions that we provide for this act, of those, two of those are definitions of a punitive and remedial sanction. Very simple definitions. Punitive sanction means a sanction imposed to punish a past contempt of court. Remedial sanction means a sanction imposed to terminate a continuing contempt of court. And then there's some additional added on thing that I can discuss later if you're of interest. But those are the two, that's the division. You've got punitive sanctions, you've got remedial sanctions. And what this bill attempts to do as you go through it is basically alert the court that depending on which of these two types of sanctions they want to impose, when they better pick it up front before they get into the proceeding, because the type of sanction that you're going to seek to impose is going to determine what kind of procedure they have to follow and what rights they're going to have to afford the person who's before them.
Do you
define two or three types of contempt? In essence, we've got a criminal contempt and remedial contempt. Is summary contempt a third one that is defined, or is it a part of the others?
Madam Chair, Senator Bunn, the summary imposition of contempt is dealt with in Section 8 of the Act. It's not defined. There is a list of sanctions that can be imposed under a summary imposition procedure.
Okay. But is the summary imposition of one of the two defined types of contempt, or is it outside of those and a third form of contempt?
Senator Bunn, it's really in its own world. And I think maybe now's a good time to come to that, since that's basically where I was going to deal with it, to kind of indicate what this bill doesn't do. What it doesn't do is really deal with the issue of summary imposition of contempt. Summary imposition is only dealt with in two places in the bill. And I hate to jump ahead, but it makes it easier as we go through now to realize that we're not talking about what we've just been discussing, summary and position, and that's in Section 8 on page 4. There's a one-paragraph reference to summary and position of sanction. Under our existing statutes, we do have a provision that talks about, quote-unquote, direct contempt. It is defined in almost exactly the same way that Section 8 defines the type of situation that exists when the court can summarily impose a sanction. It's when the person who commits the contempt of court does it in the immediate view and presence of the court. That's the first thing. It has to be right in front of the judge. He has to see it. The second thing is that the sanction may be imposed for the purpose of preserving order in the court or protecting the authority and dignity of the court. So that, I view that as something as a limitation. It has to be both those things. It's got to be in front of you, and it's got to be imposed for one of those reasons. And I think when the average person thinks about contempt, the average viewer of L.A. Law or Perry Mason, what he normally thinks about contempt is where the judge jumps from behind the bench, points his gavel at the attorney or the person out there and says, one more outburst like that, I'm going to hold you in contempt of the court. That's summary imposition of direct contempt. This bill tells you very little about that. It says the court has the authority to impose a sanction for that. It indicates that the provisions of the sections on the procedures that are applicable to other types of sanctions don't apply to summary imposition. And finally, on page 5, at line 18, you'll find that there is a limitation on the types of sanctions that a court can impose in those types of situations. Essentially, they can do a fine of $500, they can do confinement for not more than 30 days, or probation and community service.
Go ahead, please.
Madam Chair, so the line 18, number 3, is a complete list of those options available to the court then. Is that correct? So as I understand it, line 21 would clearly state then that under summary contempt, 30 days would be the maximum amount of incarceration available to a judge for summary contempt.
Madam Chair, Senator Bump, in general, that's what the bill says. There is only one caveat I put on that, and that is the statement that really begins the bill that contempt, the power to impose contempt is an inherent power of the court. I'm not sure how far that particular sentence will carry beyond what this bill does. Inherent power is a difficult area to discuss. There have been several cases with respect to how much inherent power a court has. One of the cases that dealt with it did in fact deal with whether or not the legislature could impose limitations on the type of punishment that you could impose for contempt. Said, at least with respect to the Supreme Court, that you could not limit that power, that was an inherent power.
Okay, Madam Chair, whether we specified in Section 8 the maximum allowed penalty is 30 days, or we write it as you have in Section 9, still the outcome is the same. We can make the statement, and you're saying the courts will determine whether or not we have a valid ability to do that.
Senator Bunn, I think that's the case with all the legislation we pass out of here.
I'm just trying to clarify that we didn't leave a loophole, that in fact, as far as we're concerned, we have stated the maximum penalty for as far as incarceration is 30 days under summary contempt. So we've made whatever attempt we can to set a limit, whether or not that holds. That is written in, as I understand.
I would add on to this and check that. I'm assuming also that if a judge decided to go beyond that, that they would, you know, that they'd have to justify it on their own powers as defined on 22 and as inherent, that they can allege their own inherent power, whatever that is, and somebody at that point, the case goes on up and goes
Okay, but then it would not be more effective for us to, well, I think we do say it, not more than 30 days, it's there. So if we have such ability, we've exercised the ability. Okay. Then the other question I had in the area of the summary imposition, I looked at one of the drafts that clearly stated, and it's the language has been changed before it reached us now, but has no right to counsel, no right to bail, no right to jury trial, has only those rights to refuse afforded in a civil trial, and no right to file an affidavit seeking referral to another judge. That language has been removed, but in fact, aren't those conditions existent? I mean, don't those conditions still exist in the bill by silence, if nothing else?
Madam Chair, Senator Bunn, that is what the cases basically say is the rule with respect to imposition of, quote unquote, for direct contempt, that you do not have those rights in those situations.
Okay, thank you.
Further questions while we're stopped before we urge Dave to go ahead then? Okay, please.
Having taken that detour back to Section 8, this probably makes sense to go back to the beginning now and work our way through, bearing in mind that none of
I guess that's, I mean, I'm trying to sort out where
Madam
we
Chair.
Think we are so that we can have a place to kind of begin the debate from if we are going to have a debate, and I think that's what it is.
Because I don't think F was saying that once you've served your 6 months, you're free from any responsibility for the contempt.
Right.
Right.
But in fact, you have reached the limit, just as if we put a financial limit and said once you've paid that, you'll pay no more for that contempt. Well, in essence, we're doing that with an incarceration limit, if I understand that.
Madam Chair, you could, again, in the example Senator Bunn raised, you could, at the end of the six-month period, the judge could decide, well, that was not obviously an effective remedy. So now I'm going to fine you, you know, an amount not to exceed $500 a day, and we'll see if that results in an effective remedy. So none of the Section 9 sanctions exclude are exclusive. I mean, there are.
And it could be a continuing contempt to try to get the person, coerce the person to do the right to do what was.
To do what the court ordered.
Yeah. I think we're clarified on where we probably are with the way the drafting is now, I think.
Okay, so I think I understand the intent is if you've got the woman that says, I will not tell the court where the child is, once that 6 months is up, that ends that one. She will not be incarcerated again for that contempt, although she may pay a lot of penalties. But incarceration is not one of them.
Madam Chair, Senator Bunn, I don't want to suggest that the 6 months is an absolute limit. I don't know that every judge would interpret it that way, and because this is such an inherent power of the judiciary, I'm not sure that we ought to assume.
Well, then I'll come back to my earlier comment on the 30 days, and that is that is the limit that we as legislators have stated. Whether or not the court recognizes that, it's like anything else that we pass.
That's absolutely correct, because you could have a situation where the judge would get down to subsection F of Section 9, and they would not be able to think of any effective remedy.
So they go back and they then justify it on their own inherent powers to say, we're going to do this anyway.
However, by passing legislation with this six-month language in there, you've clearly stated what the legislature thinks ought to be the outside marker.
Thank you.
Are we satisfied with where the drafting circumstances are now? Okay. Thank you, David. Thanks for the ability to clarify here.
Picking up where I left off on the procedure for imposition of remedial sanctions, subsection 11 of that section 5 indicates that inability to comply with an order of the court is an affirmative defense. I didn't have time to run back and look at that and see if that's the case now. As a practical matter, I somewhat suspect that is the case. At least in child support cases, I believe that is the case. Other, maybe counsel can help me on that, or because I'm not sure if it's the burden is on the state, for instance, in a child support case to establish that the person has the ability to pay. So if that is the case, subsection 11 certainly changes that rule, if that is the rule, because it indicates that you, as a defendant in a contempt case, have the duty of at least coming forward with a prima facie case, in other words, establishing some basic level of proof that, in fact, you were not able to comply with the order of the court. In the case of child support, were you able to pay the money? Did you have income? I keep coming back to child support, and I should mention, I don't know, but what I would imagine probably, well, certainly the great majority of all contempt cases in this state are probably child support cases. That's where most of the contempt statutes get used the most. The cases where of summary imposition, I'm sure, a small fraction, and then there is another large group of cases where there are court orders that are disregarded or not obeyed, where the court imposes sanctions. But on a day-to-day basis, the bulk of these cases are child support cases. Line 16 on page 3 indicates that proof of contempt shall be by clear and convincing evidence. This is a fairly dense bill. Every line has got something in it. It is unclear at this point, certainly it doesn't indicate in the statutes, what level of proof you have to provide to establish contempt. It's always been assumed, I believe, for purposes of child support cases, that a preponderance was adequate in those cases for those types of cases. This would raise that level to clear and convincing, which is a midway point somewhere between beyond a reasonable doubt and preponderance. It's something more than a preponderance, something less than beyond a reasonable doubt. Not the easiest thing in the world to define on an actual case basis, and I'd be hard-pressed to provide an example of it. Anyway, it's something more than just a preponderance. Subsection 13 basically indicates that the court will adopt rules to govern the imposition, the procedure for imposition of remedial sanctions, and indicates that the ORCP, except for the rule on service, doesn't apply. Section 6 is the punitive sanction provision. The decision that was made with respect to punitive sanctions was based on the FIOC case. The FIOC case basically indicated that if it's a punitive sanction, you better treat it like it was a crime. And that being the case, the question was whether or not you established another procedure for imposing a punitive sanction that looked like a criminal procedure when we already have a criminal procedure outlined in the code. And in the interest of avoiding lengthiness and also to avoid creating a new procedure solely for purposes of imposing these types of sanctions, the decision was made that you would commence and proceed in imposing punitive sanctions directly through the criminal justice procedure. You file a warrant or a complaint, criminal complaint against the person. The person has to appear at arraignment, has to enter a plea, has to be advised of his rights, has to basically go through the same thing you would as if you were accused of committing a crime. The thought on that was that since this person has all those same rights that they have in a criminal trial, they have a right to appointed counsel if the sanction that is being sought is big enough. They have a right to be advised of these rights. That duplicating system that basically says we're going to have a separate little criminal justice procedure for the purposes of these sanctions wasn't merited. So at least I think that accurately summarizes the committee's direction.
Madam Chair? In paralleling it to the criminal process, is the proof beyond a reasonable doubt, or is it also clear and convincing?
Madam Chair, Senator Bunn, it will be proved beyond a reasonable doubt that punitive sanctions.
Okay, so then they are right back to all the criminal protections except jury.
That is correct, Senator Bunn. I'm not, that basically indicates what happens in this section. I'm going to point you to the bottom line again where it talks about except for the right of a jury trial. It is sad to say that in this state, we don't really know for sure when you're entitled to a jury trial in this state. We have a case called Brown versus Multnomah County. It's 15 years old, and that case threw a lot of question as to when you have to provide a jury trial. At what level of penalty does the person have that right? As a matter of legislative policy in the criminal code now, if you are to the point where you are going to be at any level of misdemeanor, Class E, Class D, et cetera, you have a right to jury trial. It is possible, though, under Brown, that you could impose up to, you know, who knows, 6 months. The federal rule for jury trial, at least in the past, has always been pretty clear. You can go up to 6 months in jail without affording the person the right to a jury trial. Those are called petty offenses in the federal code. At the state level, it's just not clear. Brown versus Multnomah County, which was the case where the legislature attempted to decriminalize first offense DUIIs, there was no jail for a first offense DUII. And the court still said it was criminal. So, and there's a list of about five things you have to look at to try to determine if this is the type of statute that, or the type of situation where you're entitled to a jury trial. So, and this bill does not try to resolve that issue. It's a little bit beyond, I'm not sure the bill can, unless you want to try to draft one as a test case. This one just says that to the extent you're entitled to a jury trial, you are going to get a jury trial. But it does not say you're going to have a jury trial to the same extent you have under the criminal code. It does allow for the possibility that you may not get a jury trial if, I presume, if the court feels that the sentence that he's imposing is less than that, rises to the level that gives you that constitutional right. If you look at it, it does say, except for the right to a jury trial, you're entitled to the constitutional statutory protections that you'd be entitled to. And the thought behind this was that by crafting, and again, Bill can tell me if I'm wrong, but I believe the thought is that in crafting the punitive sanctions in the sanctions section under Section 9, that hopefully what is laid out there is not punitive enough to get you to the point where you are entitled to a jury trial. And that is why when you look at that section, you'll find that, at least I take it in the judgment of the judicial department, that up to 6 months is okay without a jury trial, and that a fine of not more than $500 or 1% of the defendant's gross annual income, whichever is greater, will not be enough to get you to the point where you have a right to jury trial.
Madam Chair, on this issue of jury trial, the committee decided that we did not need to extend the right to jury trial to these proceedings. That is an issue that could be challenged if this law were to be passed. And with the background of Brown versus Multnomah County, you could make arguments, I think you could make a weak argument in favor of a jury trial in these types of proceedings, but historically we have not afforded that in contempt matters, and it was just our judgment that it ought not to be, but I don't want to.
You're going to go back to argue it on the basis of federal reform, federal standards, and that sort of thing, to relate it to that.
Madam Chair, that's correct. Although, again, part of the thinking was simply that, you know, we have gone through many years in the state of judges imposing sanctions for contemptuous conduct. And as far as we know, the issue of jury trials in those cases has never been raised at trial or on appeal. I could be, you know.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, there is a case, Dwyer, State Exfield Dwyer versus Dwyer. It's a 1985 case, and maybe it's not entirely clear whether that's still correct or not. But basically, the court there held that a contempt proceeding is not a criminal prosecution for purposes of the jury trial provision of the Oregon Constitution. It's a criminal proceeding, but not a criminal prosecution, and therefore it's exempt from the constitutional jury trial requirement. I don't know if it's...
But we have such a case in 1985, whatever that is. At least it gives you some direction. Yeah. Anything else? Why don't you go ahead, Dave?
Madam Chair, I don't think there's too much more I have to say under that section. It does include the right to court-appointed counsel for punitive sanctions. I should note that the statutory provisions now in existence provide for appointed counsel in any case in which incarceration may result. That means that this bill does represent a substantial change from that statutory provision. At present, if you have a child support case that comes in where the obligor may be put in jail, even though as a remedial, what we now are referring to this bill as a remedial sanction. Under the existing statutory structure, you are entitled to an appointed counsel if you are indigent. Now, this bill does change that. And if it is a remedial sanction, you have no right to appointed counsel unless you're in jail for more than 30 days. Under the punitive provision, it indicates, again, that you will have the same right to court-appointed counsel that you would be entitled to in a criminal proceeding in which the fine or term imprisonment that could be imposed is equivalent to the punitive sanction sought in the contempt proceeding. Now, that's quite a mouthful, but what it basically means, I believe, is that if you're looking at, would it be 30 days in jail for a Class D misdemeanor, at that point you have a right to appointed counsel now in the state courts. So I presume that if you had less than 30 days, perhaps
okay, but
not.
I just want to remind committee members that we're talking about contempt now. We're not changing the basic statute of criminal law or of other kinds. So I guess I think we do need to move through this bill. We've got a long way to go. We've got two people to sign up who want to comment yet, at least. And so.
I have, Madam Chair, I have very little left. That's much the meat of it. Section 7 really is just a paraphrase of the rules with respect to arrest and compelling attendance. Some debate if even a lot of that is necessary in the bill, but basically provides for, makes it clear that you're entitled to security release if you are arrested for a contempt under the bill. For punitive sanctions, the only time that would happen, or if you disregarded a motion that was served upon you and didn't show up at the time set. Section 11 on page 5 merely clarifies some issues that have been in dispute about whether or not you could appeal a contempt judgment in a case where the rest of the proceeding hadn't been completed. In other words, you were found in contempt during the course of a proceeding. There was some question as to whether or not you had to wait till it was over before you could appeal the imposition of the contempt proceeding. Of course, you could always bring habeas corpus, which is a speedier remedy if you were chucked in jail. Section 12 essentially codifies a case that came down recently called OSB versus Wright. In that case, the court indicated that with respect to punitive sanctions, criminal sanctions, that the statute of limitations would be, in most cases, 2 years after the act or omission constituting the contempt. Section 12 merely codifies that result and makes it clear to everybody that there is a statute of limitations on imposing sanctions for contempt. And I think that pretty much deals with both of the changes that the act makes. Be happy to try to answer any questions.
Are there questions? Bill?
Madam Chair, if I could just raise a couple of other issues, and I'll do it as quickly as I can. There are two issues that came up in our discussions with the various interested parties that I want to highlight for you because they may be brought up for discussion. Section 10 has a reference to a judge recusing him or herself in a contempt proceeding and basically says that a judge may refer contempt to another judge if they deem it appropriate. It was suggested that perhaps that ought to be a judge shall. And we don't agree with that, substituting shall for may. Judges have always exercised discretion in this area. And the shall language could actually create some practical problems in some of our one and two judge counties. If over, a two-year period, assuming this bill were to pass, we find that there are any abuses of that, the issue could be reopened. But I note that just because I think it may be an issue for discussion. And then if you move to Section 16, this includes language allowing a court to appoint a special prosecutor in a punitive contempt if the district attorney, for whatever reasons, declines to prosecute. We have a similar statute that...
What section is that?
Section 16. We have a... This is... most of Section 16 is existing law. The trial courts now have an opportunity and authority under ORS Chapter 8 to appoint special prosecutors, primarily in situations where the district attorney may have a conflict. We've added language here to extend that authority to appointment of special prosecutors in contempt actions. We expect it will be very rarely used. I've discussed this with representatives of the District Attorney Association, and I think we've sort of agreed that if we find that it's being used more than rarely, that we're all going to agree to bring the issue back at some point in the future. We don't expect this to be something that's going to result in great expense to the counties. But under this existing law and then how we extend it here, that is a county financial responsibility because they are the ones who essentially fund the prosecution function. The other thing, I think I'll leave it at that and answer any questions.
Okay, thanks. Other questions of Bill? Thanks very much, thanks for your willingness to get everybody together to get this far. And I think it's a very clear improvement from where we were this stage last session. I want to thank both you and especially David, who worked with the crowd through all these many months to get this in something we can read.
Senator Hill.
Quick question. Thank you very much. In Section 6 for imposition of punitive sanctions, you're limited there as to, I'm trying to think in that situation as compared to remedial, where you have a party aggrieved by contempt of court. Now, why would it be that a party aggrieved by a contempt of court is not included in the punitive sanctions? See, in the remedial, Section 5, line 31, you have a party aggrieved by a contempt of court. As far as initiating. And then on Section 6, you're limited to the three people who can file the complaints.
Madam Chair, Senator Hill, that's in Section 6. If you go down to subsection 4, you'll find that the prosecutor may initiate proceedings on the prosecutor's own initiative on the request of a party to an action or proceeding or on the request of the court. So basically, again, following the criminal law analogy, if you want to bring one of these criminal type proceedings against this person, you have to go to the district attorney and they have to file information or accusatory instrument.
Okay. So the person who is a victim of the action by the person held in contempt
Are they just out of this process then when it's punitive?
Madam Chair, Senator Hill, you can always also, if you've been hurt by this action, you can always bring an action for remedial sanctions in addition to, so you always have that route of going through that way. It's only if you want to get this type of sanction that you have to go through the punitive sanction.
Okay, thank you.
Any other questions? Thanks very much. Thank you very much. Carl Stecker. Is that it? What do you say? Carl, it's been so long, I forgot how to pronounce your name.
Stecker, thank you.
Right, got it right.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Carl Stecker. I'm a Marion County Deputy District Attorney, and here on behalf of Dale Penn and the Oregon District Attorneys Association. We were fortunately and thankfully included early on in the process and had an opportunity to look at the bill and have very few reservations about the bill, I think, considering its complexity and its substantial overhaul of existing law. However, I have prepared some written testimony, which I would hope that you have before you today, which does enumerate some of the concerns we do have about its present form. First of all,
right on top of our file folder, 376.
As a prelude, I would mention that district attorneys throughout the state prosecute contempts primarily in two arenas. One is, as was alluded to earlier, for nonpayment of support obligations. And secondarily, we also have authority to prosecute violations of restraining orders. As near as I can estimate, there are about 8,000 contempts filed annually in the circuit courts in Oregon by district attorneys. I don't know how that compares to the numbers by the private bar, nor do I know, as far as the number that the court might initiate sua sponte on its own motion. Essentially, my perspective is that I have been prosecuting nonpayment of child support cases for over 10 years in Marion County. And as an occasion, by virtue of that experience, our office has brought in the neighborhood of about 5,000 prosecutions in that 10-year interval. At this stage, I'd like to go ahead and go into some specific sections. Basically, the current law, ORS 33040, permits the court to, in the first instance, issue a warrant. Now, that's, of course, present law does not necessarily clearly define when there is a punitive versus remedial type sanction to be imposed, and that was the issue that FEOC first raised. However, our concern is that there are certain classes of individuals who are not responsive, who are evasive, who cannot be served with a traditional show cause order or the accusatory instrument. And for that reason, the present law enables a failure to comply warrant. Now, that failure to comply warrant does not, under present law, need any advance showing that you first attempt to issue a show cause. We are conceding that might be appropriate as a first instance to attempt to serve someone. But in the event that you are unable to gain service, and there are certain transient population, if you will, and I don't mean that in the sense of indigent, but that they are mobile, and it might be a truck driver, and it might be a gentleman who's out fishing on the ocean, or it might be somebody who you just can't reach by conventional process. The practice, at least in our office, is to, after the sheriff's unable to effect service, to issue, to send a letter to that person, registered mail, indicating that there are show cause papers available at the sheriff's office to please come down and pick them up. If you don't, then we'll seek a warrant for your arrest. Under the bill as written, there is no ability now to obtain those types of warrants for the purely remedial contempt. And we think that's a serious omission. And so we have some proposed language, which is on page 4 of my testimony, coupled with another point I'll make later. And we'll visit that issue when we get to it, with that specific language. The second and probably most controversial subject for us is the appointment of special prosecutors on the county's dime. It's our essential position that this is an unfunded mandate, and We had talked with Mr. Linden and other members of the committee, and I think they're receptive, and I think the understanding, and it's been made on the record, is that this is a very limited procedure that you would envision a private prosecutor being appointed because the district attorney declined to bring a case. By way of an example, collectively in Oregon, there are well over 100,000 child support cases on the DHR system that are being enforced by district attorneys and support enforcement division and Department of Justice. In each one of those cases, 12 monthly payments accrues each year for a total of 1.2 million case annual installments or monthly installments per in a given annual time. If there's a failure to pay any one of those, it theoretically leads to a contempt of court. That's a separate instance and count for failure to abide by a court order, that failure to pay that individual installment. For practical reasons and logistical reasons, we cannot possibly collectively with justice file, if 10% of those cases didn't pay in a given month, we could not file 120,000 contempts in a year between us. And so there's necessarily going to be some criteria by which we establish a threshold level at which we will file a contempt and deem that to be an appropriate procedure. And therefore, we're asking that this section be looked at very carefully, because it's our feeling that there should be some articulated standards by which it's appropriate to appoint counsel in lieu of the DA's actions. There may be instances where we're pursuing a remedial contempt and somebody wants to have a punitive contempt brought. We may have an effective wage assignment or garnishment procedure in effect, and it's producing money, but a party or an obligee might say want their pound of flesh and want a criminal action begun. We may be prosecuting a criminal action, and I don't think it's clear under the bill that, as for reasons that were alluded to earlier about double jeopardy, whether or not pursuit of a remedial punitive contempt would exclude then subsequent criminal prosecution. But what if the criminal prosecution is first, and then the remedial contempt, or I'm sorry, punitive contempt is brought, is there double jeopardy? I mean, so there's some issues in here that concern us. What we've asked or proposed in order to get us over, I guess, the hump on this, assuming that it might be appropriate in some rare instances for the court sua sponte to want to bring an action for contempt, we've suggested at least that there be some proviso language that says, provided that other remedies have been shown to be ineffective, then the court may entertain such a request. And we'd like that to be discretionary rather than mandatory.